I didn't talk about it to my mom. But a couple of times I brought up that I saw a UFO, and she got kind of upset and just kind of brushed it under the carpet. Later on in life, I find out that she was not talking about it either because it ran in the family.
Steve Neal is an experiencer, the author of But Something Is There, also the film But Something Is There, available on YouTube. His current project, Breaking the Silence, is designed to help experiencers tell their story. And with his career in the film industry, he knows how to set the stage. The goal is to keep the format personal. No major special effects, aside from the gift he has with his art to present what the experiencer saw that's true to form. No hype, no spooky factor, a legit interpretation of what's out there or here. And I want Steve to tell his story.
I'm talking with Steve Neal, and this is an absolutely fantastic channel. I like it because it's real people, real talk, real experiencers, not kicking the tires on what are UFOs made of. Right out of the chute, away from that. And Steve Neal, N-E-I-L-L. The amazing thing is his history, his background, and I can't cover it all. So, Steve, I'm going to let you fill us in because there's a huge list of your affiliation with Hollywood and the industry behind the scenes. So, I don't know where we want to start, but I really like the Star Trek aspect. I also like Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, anything along Ghostbusters. My gosh, you were really in the right place at the right time. So if you want to start with that before we get into the experiencers, I would love to hear how it started for you.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, as a kid, I was very attracted to science fiction films in general and sci-fi books and things and in space and astronomy and science. And those were all the things that I had a really strong obsession with, literally an obsession, and from a very early age. So, you know, the first time I saw The Day the Earth Stood Still, I was in love. When I saw Twilight Zone, I was in love. When The Outer Limits came out in the early 60s, I was just blown away. I still think it's some of the best science fiction ever. And of course, as time progressed, we went through a lot of other shows that I loved. But when Star Trek came out, that was pretty amazing. You know, I loved that. But the one that really did it, at that point, I was only 16, made a career decision. What I wanted to do with my life was seeing the movie 2001, because 2001, A Space Odyssey, was not only connected with my love of science fiction, and I mean hard science fiction, not fantasy science fiction. I was never attracted to that much at all. But there was a film that showed a future that I really looked forward to and thought was very, very realistic. And the film was technically brilliant. Of course, Kubrick's a genius and obviously Clark. But there was something else going on with that movie, too, that I didn't put my finger on to many, many years later. And that is, it has a deep connection with the what we call the visitor experience, the non-human. Because the movie was about contact with non-human intelligence, plain out, simple. So that led to me wanting to be a filmmaker, which led to me, I'm getting you a short story, which led to me watching PBS a lot growing up in the Bay Area. I saw a film called THX 1138-4EB. It was a short film done by George Lucas. It was this college film that he did. And I loved that film. And then one day I read an article in a newspaper, San Francisco Chronicle, about a place called the American Zoetrope, which is headed up by Francis Ford Coppola, who I really didn't know who that was at that time. But I knew George Lucas because I knew a short film. The article talked about wanting to help young filmmakers, and their doors were open to them. Well, I was a young filmmaker, so I naively called them up and said, you know, who I was and what I was doing, and they invited me down. And so I got to meet George and Francis. I showed them my films I made in high school on Francis' big pull-down screen, and I got to be friendly with all of them, and I got to learn a lot about the industry there. But after about a couple of years, things started to kind of shut down there, and everyone was going down to L.A., which I also did. And during that time, because I loved Planet of the Apes, and I loved what they did in 2001 and other films, I loved Frankenstein, I loved all that stuff. I always wanted to know how they did that stuff, so I set out to find out how it was done. And being an artist and a sculptor, it came very easily to me. Not learning how it was done, because in those days there was not an internet. It was books, it was writing to people, it was watching television and taking pictures off the screen of things being done behind the scenes on Planet of the Apes. But from all that, I learned how to do the work and moved to Hollywood in 73 and immediately got work at 20th Century Fox, briefly on the Planet X TV series. And it kind of went from there. I just kept getting more and more work because, as you said, I was in the right place at the right time. I came down there. There weren't a lot of young makeup artists like myself that were able to do the prosthetic makeup. In other words, to be able to convincingly age someone or make them into a creature. And so, yeah, I was in the right place, right time. I started getting hired. I met Rick Baker, who's a very famous makeup artist, probably one of the most famous ever. And Dick Smith, another one, and John Chambers, who created the Planet of the Apes makeups, as well as Tom Berman. And I just got in, and so I kept working, always hoping that eventually I'd be able to make some movies. That's what how I got into the business, using my abilities doing creature work and aliens and all that kind of stuff for movies.
Well, the fun part, though, is the the laundry list of top names that you're affiliated with. And Star Trek, you know, when you're thinking about, we think about Star Trek, and you know all the characters. And then not only that, you're affiliated with other films and sets from the pictures that I have seen on your YouTube channel with the makeup that you've done, Roddy McDowall for the Planet of the Apes. And that was back when it was in a TV series. And then the other one would be The Outer Limits, Galaxy Man. Is it Galaxy Man? That was the mask.
Well, those are recreations. Yeah. I recreated those because I love them. And the funny thing about it is going back to Star Trek, when I was in high school, I used to look, I got a book, The Making of Star Trek. I used to look at the sets and stuff and everything that was going on, the props. And I said, God, it'd be so neat if I could be down there and actually know these people and work on the show. So by the time I got to Hollywood, Star Trek was over with. It was gone. But I met Fred Phillips. And Fred B. Phillips was the makeup artist for Outer Limits and the original Star Trek series. And we got to be very friendly. And one day he called me and he said, you want to work on Star Trek? And it turned out that they were doing a Star Trek movie. And I said, well, yeah, you know, and so he had me come down and do Spock's ears to start with. Before that, though, I used to do the science fiction and Star Trek convention circuit to sell masks and stuff and Spock ears that I was making. And of course, Gene Roddenberry and Majel, his wife, saw my work, loved it. We got to be friendly. And so when Fred brought me up to them, they said, oh yeah, bring him in. So I was in hog heaven, and I've never gotten over it. It was just the most amazing thing. I was just a young guy to be on that back lot with those people, working with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and everybody. I was on cloud nine. It was just one of the best things that ever happened to me. So it was really a full turnaround there, and I ended up working on two Star Trek movies, or was it three, and then a pilot for Next Generation. So it was fantastic. So, you know, a lot of times I would recreate stuff that I really loved, and then those masks would end up being something other people wanted and they would sell.
Now, you're doing all of this, which is pretty, you know, amazing, fantastic. If you're into pop culture, anybody who's listening will know the films that you're involved in. But behind the scenes, there's another aspect of your life that's even more fantastic than what you were living. And when did you decide to actually tune in to that and allow it to be front and center?
Well, I had always been tuned into it. I just didn't talk about it. And I didn't talk about it to my mom. But a couple of times I brought up that I saw a UFO. She got kind of upset and just kind of brushed it under the carpet. Later on in life, I find out that she was not talking about it either because it ran in the family. So, you know, it wasn't something that you talked openly about. I did not start talking about it till about 1990 when I met Whitley Strieber and Yvonne Smith. I knew something was going on because when I read Communion, like so many other people, that was 1987, I believe, is when that book came out. I didn't know Whitley yet, but I read the book and I said, uh-oh. it was basically it because, okay, there's all this stuff that you keep to yourself. You don't talk to other people. There's no support groups and things like that going on back then. There was nothing like that. And no one talked to each other about it. And everybody thought that it was just them. They did, myself included. Yeah. I thought, you know, it was unique. Whether or not I actually accepted that I was in contact with something unknown or not, there was no way to confirm that, or did you even think about finding out, did this stuff happen to anyone else? When you read Communion and you're reading through that and you're seeing your own experience in a book from someone you don't even know, that was mind-boggling. And that's when the light bulb went on. You said, oh, my God, you know. And, of course, right at that period in time, too, the activity that I've experienced was very, very high. But I still wasn't connecting it. I still wasn't thinking to myself, I had actual contact with non-humans. I thought I was seeing a lot of UFOs. I was seeing them close up and personal. I was seeing blue lights come into the house and all that. But I still didn't connect those dots until I read that book.
See, that's what's so odd, is that our autopilot go-to is, it's just a dream, imagination. It takes a little while to get the sequence together where, oh my gosh, this is my reality. Why am I not connecting it? What's the block? And I think that might be sanity.
Sanity, yeah, it's the brain trying to protect itself. It's a defense mechanism, and you know, it's why, it, and it still works, because, you know, once I did start talking about it and almost got divorced over it and everything else, you know, I'm going into the kitchen one night, 3 a.m, after waking up from feeling quite odd and everything felt odd, but I was fully awake, and I go into the kitchen, and my late wife had left a butcher box right in front of the refrigerator, so I couldn't open it to get some water. And I thought, that's so odd. What the heck's going on? I stared at it for a second, and its legs started to move. Then I realized it wasn't four legs, it was two. And then I realized it wasn't a butcher block at all. It was a being, and it looked at me briefly, and it just blurred into the wall and was gone. But my mind probably was seeing what was actually there, but couldn't get around it, so it looked for the color of the wood was sort of tan, and the being was sort of tan, and so I think my mind just went, well, that's the butcher block, and it's, you know, and when it started to move, it broke that.
I like the way you're describing it, because that's so real. It's when it's that far out of your frame of reference, then there's this, sometimes they call it a screen memory. I don't think that's accurate. I've even said myself, it's a screen memory. I think I couldn't fix it and put it together what it was quick enough to understand and make that leap, that connect. No, this is something unique and different and real.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing about this is experiencers are going through different, I think, contact experiences, and whether we're not going to get into why, but the difference is you had the Men in Black, you had the other element into it in terms of harassment and those kind of things that also plays a part. Not everyone goes through that. And why, you know, why would that have been? Maybe because of your level of fame, contact, that you were going to pop the jar on this too early, you know, pop the cork, maybe I should say that, on this too early, because now you're able to do it and you don't seem to have the same backlash.
No, well, I'm a lot older now, and they probably figure, what's this old guy going to do? But you know, I don't know. To tell you the truth, I just don't know. When I started watching X-Files, I was just like, really? You know, because that stuff was all happening to me, and sometimes Whitley was present when those things occurred, and other people were, my friends saw it. There were friends of mine that didn't pay attention to television, didn't know I was on the air talking about this stuff, and so they'd come over and they'd see things over the house or experience something in the house that they couldn't explain, and then I had to kind of break it to them. But my wife really was upset by it, because initially she thought that, you know, I was off my rocker, but as time went by, she started to experience and see the things that I was seeing. And then, of course, I was accused of making her crazy. It was really ugly, and you probably heard about this. But something was trying to destroy my life because I was talking about this stuff publicly, and yet other people, as you said, were and not having this problem. Many of them were. You know, I know Carla Turner was and many others. And Whitley had his fair share of harassment. I met Whitley in 1990, and that was really the peak of, and we became friends, hit it off right away, but it was sort of the peak of all this really starting to happen. So he said, it's probably all his fault. And I said, well, no, not entirely. But,
oh, nice try. But,
yeah, nice try. But, you know, I really don't know. Maybe it was because of my affiliation with Whitley and he was, you know, getting so much fame and notoriety. And I was appearing on shows with him and stuff. But the two emails I got, one from the NSA and one from the, I think it was three, FBI, NSA, and CIA. And they all basically said the same thing, that you weren't supposed to talk about this. There was some discussion that I had broke my security. I had a security clearance and I wasn't supposed to talk about it. And I've heard other people say that they were told they had a security clearance too, but I don't know how the heck I got it. I'm not in the military. I never took an oath or swore to be secret, but this stuff came up and I sort of discounted it. Jeff Rentz was behind that a lot because he looked at the emails. He said, these got to be fake, you know? And I said, well, yeah, somebody trying to scare me. But when I got the phone call from the studio and they told me that basically guys in dark suits came in that were very scary and said I was in trouble with the law and it wasn't in their best interest to work with me anymore, that's when it got nasty. I had a feeling that maybe those emails were actually real. Because that did happen, and my work started to go away really quickly.
That's what's a little bit disconcerting about this. It did get real, and then your wife obviously had a reason to be insecure, threatened, frightened, and not comfortable.
Yeah, being followed home by a helicopter, hovering so low you could feel the air pressure off the blades, and it was so loud that it attracted everybody in the neighborhood, because it was broad daylight, out to see, you know, what we had done. They thought we were in trouble for selling drugs. They thought we were selling drugs because they would see expensive cars pulling up all hours of the night into my driveway, not realizing that I was doing work for the studios and that, you know, a lot of the stuff I had to hand over late at night. And there were always cars over there and stuff. And it was the studios coming over and people that I worked with. The helicopter was so ridiculously low. It was real scary. And it followed her. It had been following her, and that's what really unnerved her. It got to a point where she said, you have to get out of this, or I'm going to leave you. So that was about late 2009, and I left the community. I did not come back until she passed away in 2013.
Wow. See, I had an experience in 2009 that I still don't, to this day, I don't know. I had telepathic contact saying that there was basically somebody following me and somebody also in the house, and I could hear them. And the telepathy had to do with there was something laying out on the counter. It was a picture that was half in and half out of a notebook, and it said, Bob's your uncle. My Bob uncle had just died. And so he was deceased, and it's saying, Bob's your uncle. It knew it was there. There were things planted in my house. I was super paranoid at the time, so I couldn't tell if it was me or what was going on. But the other thing was that helicopter, that whoo, 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 whoo. Okay, that's over the house. Somebody ran out of my house. I had barricaded myself in the bottom of the floor with the basement door barricaded so nobody could come in and out, and heard there was another breezeway that had a door, heard that door slam. I was told telepathically, do not intervene, do not engage, stay put. And that was what I did. The next morning, that door was wide open. And after that had kind of crescendoed, there's more to it, but that had crescendoed, then the activity backed off. But there was telepathic contact at that time saying what to do about this scenario.
Wow.
And, you know, other than that, there's no way you can prove anything like that.
No. And they know that. So,
yeah.
You know, they do.
So
I had the phone taps too, and I've had people interrupting conversations saying, you know, this phone call is being monitored, you're violating security and all this stuff.
I look back on it now
and I just think, did that really happen? And yeah, it did.
My thing was, it felt like it was protecting me from something, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I was protected and everything was free and clear, then that dropped. But since then there've other things that have happened, but it hasn't been negative. I just thought, okay, there's something else going on here. The variation in our experiences, in some cases, I wasn't going public with any of this, and I did not. It was 2009, and I didn't start really talking about some of this until later on. I'd already had an experience in 1997 that changed my life, but it wasn't a UFO. It was, for me, it was, you know, a spiritual, what they call it, an STE, a spiritually mm-hmm. transformative event. Okay, so that mm-hmm. that happened, and so I was on a different playing field with that, this other element, channeling those kind of things, but kept it kind of low profile, except that when this happened, it blew my mind. It blew my mind. I'm experiencing an alternate reality and being told yeah. you will experience this, and do not telegraph what you're experiencing, because then you'll cause more basically fallout in whatever this, whatever you're in. Don't engage. All right. Again, when they said in the house, don't engage, you'll see this, do not engage. And I tell you, when something like that is available and accessible in our day-to-day reality, there is nowhere to go. And that's why I love the fact that you are bringing people together and saying, we need to hear the stories. We need to be able to somehow put a context with this. When you went into your hypnotherapy and doing the regression, what did you learn mm-hmm. that you didn't know?
You know, the funny thing is I remembered a lot of it, but not enough. There was stuff that just was real sketchy. And so I wanted to see if there was more. And so that's why I met Yvonne. And I met her in 1989. And I think about 1990, I started working with her doing regressions. And the first really clear incident that I can recall was the one where I described waking up in a vacuum, complete utter silence, and I lived in San Francisco. You know, there were lights coming in my room. In fact, if you watch the film, but something is there, that whole thing is reenacted, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, and that's all I remembered. I mean, I saw something, and it had a big head and all that stuff, but I don't remember anything that happened after that. And when she put me under hypnosis, it was blocked. She couldn't get past it. I couldn't get past it. And just, it was blocked. But later on, when I went to more recent experiences that were happening quite often during the 90s, we did get a lot more details. You will normally, as a healthy person, question it, because you can't be 100% sure that what you're recalling actually happened. But then again, there will be things that happen when you go to the support group later that will sort of verify that it did, especially if it involved other people that you knew within the group. I think the most striking thing that ever happened in all of the regressions I did was when she was bringing me up, which I was very used to, the procedure where you're brought out of hypnosis, she couldn't bring me out. And this tall being, you know, with the big wraparound eyes, you've seen the artwork I've done, stood over me. She's a female. I'm really aware of her probably throughout my life as I look back. She was really kind of annoyed by Yvonne, and this is how it appeared. And it was weird. I mean, it was like I was in dark limbo, but she was very present. I think there was another one behind her, but the main focus was her. She's standing over me, and she's listening to Yvonne, and then she goes to me and she says, why are you coming to this woman? Don't you know she can't help you? And then she puts her hands around my neck and pulls me forward. She says to me, if I don't want to let you go, I don't have to. And then she just released me, and I went back away from her, and then I came to. But Yvonne the whole time is, you know, 1, 2, 3, fully awake, fully awake. Yeah. You can hear her. She's getting kind of freaked out because I'm not coming out. She said, what was going on in there? And I told her. And, you know, this being, she was trying to make a point.
Yes. Yeah.
And I got the feeling that that was absolutely real. So.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I make up? I mean, why would I come up with something like that? You know?
If the person had wings, we would call it divine intervention. But
yeah,
this isn't,
yeah.
And that's the whole thing about this. It's so in between, and we can mm-hmm. ask all these questions, but we really don't have a grip on what is the purpose, what is the point. And you can say, well, they're yeah. adversarial, they're contrary, they're running, you know, some kind of a dark web intervention, and all that. Mm-hmm. We don't know. So until we can.
But my gut.
Go ahead.
My gut feeling is that this is all in our best interest after all these years, because it seems like everything we go through in life, in existence, in this universe is a form of a gauntlet, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just the experience of having a baby for a woman is going through a gauntlet of severe pain and trauma, but look what happens in the end.
The thing I compare it to is like a veterinarian. When we mm-hmm. take our pets to the vet, mm-hmm. they are absolutely stark, well, not everybody. Some pets, they get there and they go, like, you love me. No, no, no. I have the ones that go, get me out of the car.
Yeah, on the way. I know.
Okay.
I know.
And so not only that, if they have certain kind of drugs where they are still available, like the ketamine, if they have that, they're still aware of what's going on. And it has to be absolutely frightening to the hilt. And yet, you know, it's for in their best interest. I see that as the kind of thing that's happening here. And the only way that somehow you'll take a hint is when the guy shows up and says, we're not going to let you make any more money, honey. Unless you stop and take this seriously, you're out of business. And so that's the only way that they could relate to us because of the UFO not being real aspect, that the men in black get make the point.
Suppose so. And we don't know who they are.
No. My experience with them was in a dream. And in the dream, they came up to me, and this is one of those surreal kind of things. And I knew it was real. Even though I'm in this dream, I know it's real. This black limo, black car comes up in a field, and I'm standing out in the field, out full moon kind of night. Three men in black, can't see their faces. I don't remember because it wasn't the features weren't hard, harsh, memorable. But I knew when they were talking to me, this was really important. And they said, we need you to do what you agreed to do when you came here. And somehow I knew that I had to make some changes in my life that were that were very, very important. And I knew what to do. There was nothing said. It was just, we need you to. And so then I started talking more about this, which is what I had not been doing. So that was different. And there was the men in black. And that was the whole purpose of that. I think it's some kind of a code or something that we tune into and we know the information without knowing.
Maybe. Because there's no question that, you know, I was threatened to stop talking about it. And when I did, it stopped.
Yes.
But now, you know, I made the first film, But Something Is There. And I made that in 2018 is when it was released. And I haven't had any trouble at all. Now, Breaking the Silence is different because I did not expect, and I think we're on the 10th or 11th day since we actually launched the first video. Started all this. And in that time, we have almost 200,000 views and 5,000, over 5,000 subscribers. And, you know, I've been around a long time with YouTube, things like that. And I know that's pretty much unheard of. I don't quite know what to make of it because it's happening so quickly. But you can be sure that it's got somebody else's interest as well. I mean, YouTube's been sending out, I found out from some of my subscribers that they've been sent out questionnaires or something like that, where they're asking them what they thought of that something is there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was shown that. And it's like, well, that's new to me. I've never heard of YouTube doing something like that. You know, why are they asking my subscribers what they think of my work? And I don't know, maybe it's a new thing they're doing. I have no idea, but they're definitely taking notice, and this is only going to keep growing. It grows by the hour, and the amount of correspondence I'm getting is over the top. I've got people that want to come from Stockholm here, paying their own way to go in front of the camera because they have a message from the visitors that they feel is very important to tell. I've been told a great deal by a lot of people, not the vast majority of them, that I'm not vetting well enough. And I thought that was kind of a cruel thing. I mean, who am I to decide who's telling the truth and who isn't, whose experience is real and who isn't? I mean, obviously, if I get a psychopath who says he's been living on the surface of Mercury, I'm going to have second thoughts about that person. But the people are contacting me with these amazing stories.
Yes.
They're the most level-headed, sane, kind, and gentle, loving people I've ever met. And there's millions of them.
Yes.
And they want to come forward and talk about this.
This is global.
And they're
going to.
Yeah, it is. It's just that's sort of the emails from all over. It's getting to a point, and it's only just started, that it's taking up all my time, which is fine. You know, because right now I'm sitting here putting an armature inside of a gray type being that was described by Camille, who is our next show that's going to air this Saturday, if I can get it finished in time. And so I'm trying to show people what she saw, little bits and pieces, not a lot. I think less is more, but, you know, I'm sitting here trying to do this and cut her show and keep up with email and interviews and everything else. It's kind of overwhelming, but this is the best time probably in my life for this to happen because I'm not employed by the studios anymore. I don't have that pressure on me. And, you know, I have some money, so I really don't need to work so much. Yeah. And I'm sure this will generate some income too, because, you know, when your show gets popular, then people want to advertise and things like that. And they also, we got a person who's very into the subject matter, who has a lot of money, who wants to invest in it, and yet he doesn't want to have any control over it. He wants it to remain just how it is, which is miraculous, but I don't think he'll be the last person to do this. So the more income we get from this, the better shows we can do, the more equipment we can get. I mean, we have a lot of equipment right now in the 2,000-square foot studio. I'm a little tired. and you know, lots of computers and editing material, and I know how to do visual effects and editing. I've been doing it for years. It's my hope that if we can generate some support financially to this, that I'll be able to bring in more people.
Steve Neal, Breaking the Silence. A quick break. Steve Neal is a film industry pro, television and film. He's a special effects makeup artist, filmmaker, puppeteer, model maker, visual effects, and you can check out his website and his models and the art he creates, Steve Neal's art blog on WordPress. He has a new project now, interviewing experiencers, and you can get to know more about him by watching his film, But Something Is There. The focus with experiencers who are telling their stories, Breaking the Silence.
And again, if I bring in assistant editors, people who work with me on the camera crew and stuff like that, they all have to be people who are involved. I won't work with any outsiders, because anybody I put in front of the camera is going to be uncomfortable, as I was. You go on these shows and you sit down and the camera crew and everybody in the audience be looking at you like, oh, brother, here we go, you know. But the setting I put Daphne in, if you saw her story,
yes,
it was Mary and I and the camera. And we put a good lavalier on her and let her go. And that's what I want to stick to, because that's never been done before. And Hollywood never will do it that way, because they want to turn it into a horror show and get ratings. And
Travis Walton was one of the people
yeah.
who was taken advantage of.
Oh, yeah. I was at a MUFON meeting, and Tracy Torme was there, who I already knew. And he's on stage, and I said, I'm going to get this guy, because the audience is just eating it up. And thinking, you know, they all had stars in their eyes and stuff. And I kept putting my hand up. And finally, he said, okay, Steve, let's hear it. And I said, oh, Tracy, I got to ask you a question. He says, get it over. I said, okay. Why did you turn this into a horror film, science fiction horror film? Why was the abduction scene completely inaccurate? And he got mad. He yelled at me. He said, Steve, what would you have me do? You know the business, because he knew, you know, I worked in the business just like he did. He said, you know, the producers told me if we see those black-eyed creatures one more time, you don't have a film. We're not going to do it. You can't stick to what Travis described and went through. And I said, but Tracy, they didn't have black eyes. They had brown eyes. And you just see everybody, a pin drops, everybody look at me, and the MUFON people told me to sit down, you know, because here they got this special guest and, you know, they're trying to make a big deal out of it. And here comes along a damp cloth like me who spoke truthfully about what they did was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter about the money. You don't do that. If you do that with his film, you're going to do it with everybody's experience. And then nobody's going to know what these people really experienced. And they've done it time and time and time and time again.
That's the thing about this, is so frustrating when you've experienced it, because you brought something legit. They said that's of no value. We can't make money off of it.
Yeah, it's no good to us. Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, because in the first place, they don't take the subject matter seriously anyway. And they basically think you're that nice guy, but you're crazy. You know, I got that a lot.
Well, so. the vetting thing. How do you know how to vet somebody when you've never experienced this yourself? You have to have the real thing, the real experience, to understand what changes. The environment changes. All of a sudden, it's like, you know, you're around, and when you're saying there's no, it's completely silent, there's also this, a different smell in the air, and there's a different, your chest, you feel different. All these things are part of it. They don't talk about that.
No, and the only person who's ever really treated this subject matter fairly is Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
And that's because he knows a lot more than the public realizes. and we'll just kind of leave it there. Because
well, but he also leaves it open. He doesn't try to put too much context to it. So it's you can decide for yourself this mm-hmm. is fiction or if it's real. And I think that's the best way so far that it's been able yeah. to be addressed without technically being addressed, because people are still looking at the sky going, well, what kind of machine are they using? And it's like, you know what? It isn't even in
if
our
it
dimension.
Even is a machine. Yeah, I yeah. know.
Well, and the other thing, recently there was an octopus sighting. You know, there was an octopus. And when I realized what they were, because I said, I have a picture. A friend sent me, maybe what was 2011, something like that, of this octopus UFO. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. it doesn't match what they're talking. They're talking about some kind of a vehicle. What she talked about and what she called, oh, they're here again, the UFOs, the ETs. And it was a pink being with these tentacles that was outside of her window. I think she was on the second floor. And she did wow. take a picture. She was saying, oh, they're here again. They're kind of a reddish, orangish, pinkish kind of glow. And these guys aren't talking about that at all. I thought, okay, well, I've got the wrong octopus.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah. But those kinds of beings also are here. And just because,
I'm sure there's multitudes of them. Yeah. One of the other things that I get comments, I would say 98% of the comments are all very kind, loving, and very supportive. And that's a huge amount. But you get these other comments. And one of the ones that stuck out to me is they're talking about Daphne. And they said, would you please vet these people? I was on board with her story until she brought up that New Age crap about the Bashar. Was talking about Daryl Anka, who I know, they're cherry picking this stuff. You know, how do you know? How does anyone know whether Daryl's really channeling another intelligence or not?
Right, right.
None of us know for sure.
Yeah.
And when I went to listen to him, everything that being channeled through him spoke about was positive, supporting, loving, and told people to be positive and pursue their passions and embrace life. There was nothing negative about it at all. Even on the most basic level, what he's doing is helping people. What is the harm in it?
Well, it's also her story. And so she is entitled to put value on whatever
sure.
works for her.
It doesn't discount her experience because she hangs out with Daryl Anka.
Yeah.
I've hung out with Daryl Anka too. He's a nice guy. He also works in the movie business, and that's how we know each other. But yeah. I got a feeling on some level that he really is channeling something. Some of the things he knows about and can be asked about by very brilliant people, he can answer, and his education doesn't support that. So there's something going on there. Well, as the movie says, but something is there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so with the group and breaking the silence, you are getting a good grip on how to present this and how to just kind of roll with the punches, go with the flow. Where do you anticipate at this point? Where do you anticipate going, like in the next 6 months, 8 months?
I don't know. When I look ahead at the rate it's going and the things that I know about that are about to happen as a result of this, I see it getting pretty big. That concerns me a little bit because when things get big, then people with money come along that aren't involved and want to take it away from you. And that's something I will not allow to happen. It's called selling out. And I've known plenty of people that have done it. And that's something that I just will not allow. My whole purpose of doing this is giving these millions of people on this planet a voice so that they can affect the consciousness of this planet, which is needed very badly if the human race is going to survive. It has to, at the very least, start paying attention to the stars at night again, or for that at all, which they don't do. I mean, I talk to so many people, they never look at the sky. They never connect with nature or creatures crawling around near them or anything like that. They're like totally disconnected from, in my opinion, reality.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous, and it's what's killing our planet. So most of these people, the millions and millions of them that I hope come forward, pretty much all have the same message. I think if that many people start sharing that message and the public becomes aware of it, they might start to take it seriously enough to affect change.
At the consciousness level, when these kinds of experiences happen and people talk about it, it's very similar to someone who's had a near-death experience?
The near-death experiences and this experience are all connected. So,
well, I was waiting for people to talk about having a near-death experience and seeing the ETs. And that's,
right.
Yeah, that's taken a while, but they're out there.
And I've had a near-death experience, not because I was dying, but because someone I knew was dying, and they and I did not know they were dying, and they made their way to me and pulled me out of my dream into their reality, and the next day I found out they had passed away. And this also happened to my mother. It ran in the family. But it was just a weird series of events. It was in the 70s. I had this girlfriend, and she was staying with me at my house in Burbank. I was working for Roger Corman on a movie called Battle Beyond the Stars. She didn't spend the night that night. She stayed at a friend's house. I had this dream and woke up around 6. The dream was I saw her. She was naked except for a pair of panties. She was floating in this cloudy, misty sort of realm. I could hear this really cliche-sounding New Age ambient music in the background, and she floated out towards me, and she grabbed me, and she hugged me, and she told me that I had been right about so many things, including there were aliens here on the planet, and that she had to go, and that she wanted to say goodbye, and that she loved me, and then she sort of backed away and into these colored clouds and disappeared, and I woke up, and I said, "What the hell was that? Oh, God. It's 6:30. I got to get going. I got to be at the studio because we're having a premiere of the film." And so I rushed on down to the film, saw the film, came back home. There were all these messages on my machine that she had passed away around that time in the morning, and that she died from, a brain aneurysm.
Oh, wow.
And when, but there was also a suspicion of foul play, which is what police are, you know, they're good at that. When they took me down for questioning to find out where I was that night, all this kind of stuff, because she was very beat up looking when the pictures they had of her, but evidently that was from the paramedic strain resuscitator,
mm-hmm.
but they thought there might've been foul play. So they were checking everything out and they said, "Well, you know, she's found, right? She's naked in a pair of panties." And that just floored me. I got so sick. I got food poisoning or something. It was the worst sickness I ever had, and it couldn't have been from food, because that night a friend of mine and I both went to an Indian restaurant, and we had curry, and it was from the same bowl, and that maybe there was something in my part that I ate he didn't get, I don't know, but I was sick as a dog for a few weeks, and then I finally started to come around. But I'll never forget that as long as I live. And the part that just cracked me up about it was her telling me, "And you were right about the aliens." I mean, you know, who's going to believe that? But it really happened, and it was real. And I felt the free fall, and I felt being out of my body, and it was just an amazing thing. So it's not uncommon in my family. My mother had the same thing.
Your mom didn't talk about it, and when you tried to talk about it, why did she check out?
Probably because she didn't want to go there. Maybe it was the dark family secret at that point. But, you know, she had been around my step-grandfather, who she was crazy about, as I was, Phil Carnahan, who, you know, worked on the development of the bomb in World War II and also worked at Berkeley at Nuclear Accelerator, and he also designed a camera that could photograph the splitting of an atom and just all these things, and he was deep in the deep secret stuff. This stuff was all around us, but I didn't know till, you know, like the year before she passed away that she had had experiences, and the one she described to me was more recent when my grandmother was still alive, because she lived with her out in Sebastopol. She lived on a ranch out in the middle, kind of in the country, and they'd sit on the porch at night, and she saw this black circle. She could see it because it was blotting out the stars.
Yeah.
And it came towards the house, and then some lights started to appear softly in the middle of it, which then beamed down on the porch, and they felt a little nervous from it, so they went in the house, and the lights followed her in the house, and came to the windows, I guess, and she sort of went silent after that, and I said, "So what happened next?" She says, "You know, I don't know," and that was her way of telling me. Before that, we hadn't talked for years, because we never did get along very well. When we started talking again, she said, "By the way, I've seen you on all those TV shows," and I'm like, "Oh boy, here we go." I said, okay, Mom. She said, no, it's not what you think. I believe you. I mean, she was real, real careful about it. She didn't go into a lot of details. She said, I believe you. And she told me about some experiences she had with her grandmother passing away and peering on her bed at night and talking to her. But she was careful. I think she was hoping that it didn't get transferred to me. So when I brought it up, and there were numerous occasions I did when I, you know, found myself out on the balcony of our house in Pacifica looking at a UFO up by the Nike base, which we lived right near, she got real angry at me. But the next morning, I remember yelling at me, there are no UFOs, and go to bed. And so the next morning, she comes in and she throws the Chronicle, or the Pacifica Tribune, I think it was called, was the local newspaper in Pacifica, and she threw it down. There's that UFO you told me about. It was in the newspaper that it had been seen. Other people had seen it that night up by the Nike base. So she was just kind of keeping it down.
With the other thing, too, the involvement of your stepfather?
Your step-grandfather, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
He was a brilliant man.
See, that's a really interesting connection that you have.
Well, a lot of us have a connection like that in our families, with military, with top secret clearances. My dad worked on nuclear submarines. You know, he wasn't in the Navy. He was an engineer that was involved in the designing and development and also the refit of submarines out at Mare Island.
There's a guy who's in his 80s. His name's John Foster. He's in Nebraska, and his background includes work on some secret projects and nuclear work and things like that. And he remembers from very young age, when he put the pieces together back in 1986 and had some health issues as a result because it was so far out of his paradigm that it basically made him have a heart attack. Anyway, he has memories of being told that they were working on certain projects and they were expected to complete certain projects. So that part of it I find fascinating too, that there has to be more to it.
There is. And I mean, we had a support group meeting here recently because we're hosting them for a bond because up here in Ventura, there are people that work with her, but it's a long way for them to travel to go to Pasadena. You know, it's like an hour and a half, 2 hours. So we offered to have a satellite group here, and we just had a meeting recently, and a lot of the people in it all had military backgrounds or had connections or were military brat kids, and it's very, very common. Very, very, very common. So,
you said you're working on a character right now for the next segment. Are you?
Yeah.
You also talked about you had the studio. Why not do this yourself? And you just mentioned somebody who has possibly a lot of money wanting to throw it at you. Would this be that they are looking at some of the stories and potentially looking at as fodder for other, you know, for another like a series? Do you have that sense of these things beginning to take form?
Not really, but I wouldn't rule it out. I do know that the man involved, and I don't know if he wants me to mention his name publicly or not, he has experiences himself. He worked with Stephen Greer for a while, went to his C5 groups and stuff like that, and he's been very involved and had a pretty traumatic, very incredible experience himself. And I know he wants me to cover that one in detail a lot more than we're doing in these 30-minute shows, so it may lead to that. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. If this goes mainstream and it keeps its integrity and the people involved making the show are all experiencers or people who have a real honest interest in it, then that will allow it to be the best possible show on this subject matter it can be. Because what's been wrong in the past is the people making these shows. I used to work for the History Channel for the UFO Files, and I used to work for Fox when I did sightings, stuff like that. The people doing the shows have no interest in this at all. It's a job. This is what we're doing now. It's interesting, though, that in a lot of cases, the producers that I worked with went from being complete skeptics to being people that understood that there's really something to this, and then they got really devoted to it. Then suddenly they weren't working anymore and didn't have the money and power to do something like we're doing. Now you don't need it because, you know, you need some money, obviously. You can't shoot this with cell phones. I suppose you could, but, you know, we have real cameras and real sound equipment and real editing and all that stuff. But that's because I've amassed all this stuff over the years and have the experience to work with it. So as long as it stays to that formula of working with people, producing this. I don't care if they have a lot of money and they want to make this go mainstream and end up on, you know, one of the major networks, as long as the network doesn't try to define what the show is supposed to be. And they'll often do that because we, Whitley and I have worked several times on shows for Arts and Entertainment, NBC, and they've made us great promises. And we got with Arts and Entertainment, the show we did with them was incredible. The producer that was behind that show brought the cut to Whitley's place in Santa Monica. We went down and showed it to both Whitley and I, and it was beautiful. It was wonderful. It was everything we hoped for. Once Arts and Entertainment got a hold of it, they cut it down to a half hour. They put in skeptics. They made it look like a laughingstock. They do this every time. And I'm so sick and tired of it. I will not allow that to happen with this ever, or I'll shut it down. I don't care how much money they offer me because I don't have a price. There's other things I can do. I have my hobbies, and, you know, I can go enjoy those and the hell with it.
When Edgar Mitchell was involved with the group, it was free, the free group, and that was to do, they put out like 5,000 surveys. And I took part of that, and I tell you what, they were in-depth surveys trying to figure out what people were experiencing. And when you have that many people participating, that's just the ones who heard about it and found out about it. You know, it's word of mouth. Mm-hmm. There was no big push to try and make this a huge marketing thing. But the kinds of experiences that they had that then drew other people to the table is global. So there are still people finding out about this who do not speak English. They've had their own experiences, and we have to find translators to figure out, okay, what happened in Germany, what happened in South America, and what happened in Australia, you know, all the indigenous people who also have these experiences. When this sure. becomes global, as it is beginning to do, this is going to become more real for everyone.
Exactly. And that's the whole idea behind it, is time to get this over. We are part of something huge. And, you know, people look down on themselves and look down at the ground. They never look up. I'm quoting that film, don't look up. Please look up. Because once humanity realizes their greater reality, the reality that extends beyond this planet and far out into the reaches of this cosmos, and they actually connect with it, going to change their whole sense of being and their whole attitude. I would hope that it would end the aggression, the hate, and the war, and the greed, and the destruction to their own backyard. The only kind of people that would destroy their own environment were people who think they weren't connected to it, that they were separate from it somehow, some way. And I can suggest things, but I won't because it's political. And, you know, we don't go there because, you know... You just don't.
Well, it's
enough to say this is going on. And
yeah.
So
it's necessary. And so, yeah. I mean, I think there was an acid spill somewhere in South America and they showed the river just full of bubbles. They said this was an additive for soap. And so now it's that whole river is polluted. They had to shut down the support system that gives the community their water, fresh, clean water. And, you know, these things are happening all over the world. And these are the kind of things that when you become more aware of the connection and all of this other stuff, you don't want that to happen.
No. And, you know, waking up at 2 a.m. to go to the bathroom, stepping into a foot of water in your house and rising, for me, that was a month and a half ago that happened, and our house was, had to completely be dismantled and being rebuilt right now. And it'll probably happen again, is all related to this too. I mean, it's related to climate change, which is drastically affecting our climate to such a degree that places that never get flooded are. Our coastlines here where I live are rising at breakneck speeds. They're starting to flood in on the expensive homes and the beaches. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And as my second film said, the log line was, you were warned, but you didn't listen. People are starting to listen now, you know, it's like an intersection. Until somebody gets killed crossing the sidewalk in it, they won't put a stop sign up. And so that's unfortunately the way we work.
And these are the more significant warning signs, the saying, okay, you can't ignore it now. So
no,
you still
can't,
have time.
But they still are. The people who have the most power and the most greed and the most money are still tossing the dice. They're still denying it in the name of more money than they can ever possibly need or use in their lifetime. So, and we'd probably all have longer lifetimes too for that as well. I mean, we can go on for hours and hours about this, but even the food they're selling us is just, it's garbage.
However,
Mary and I have completely changed our eating habits. We bought an electric car, so.
That's what this is about though. That's why, you know, this is, it's now a time when people can relax, let go, take this more seriously, because more and more people are coming forward and saying this is real. And this seems to be, that's why it was put off, derailed, really derailed intentionally, to get it to a time when there's no imagining global climate shift. It's here.
Yeah.
And before it was just like, here. You know, it was like, oh, that's fear mongering. And the scientists who are studying it going, this isn't fear-mongering, but, you know, what are we going to do? So now that it's here, then this can be actually a very real and present danger.
Of course, the next thing is that there's more life out in space that's intelligent, that's been here, is going to be here, and has been here, is going to be known globally as well. And that's really going to create a shift in consciousness. It's amazing how much of it is, and it's even happening right here where I live. I mean, more and more people in my local area here, and I know all over the world, who are not interested in the subject are getting interested in it because they're seeing UFOs themselves, maybe walk of life, and they're putting it on camera. I've been seeing the footage. It's been posted on the local next door here, and I think the most wonderful part about it is how people are reacting to it. They're not making fun of it anymore. They're taking it seriously. So that's about to break.
Of all your experiences, the things that we can't explain, that we can't prove, but we know are real, what was the one that changed you the most? What made you decide to become more conscious and present and go forward with this?
Oh, geez. That's a good one. I've had so many. I can't even begin to tell you which one it would be. It doesn't stand out because they all stand out. But I'd have to go back to the very first time it happened to me when I was a kid. And that experience never left me ever. The detail that I remember about it and everything else from that point on, I wanted people to know, and I didn't know how to do it, but I wanted people to know that there was something else. And when I saw the UFOs as well, staying out with my grandfather out in Marin County, you know, with my other grandmother up in the mountains, when I saw them and they were clearly flying metal-looking objects, I wanted to share this with the world because I thought it was important.
So you cover it in the movie, But Something Is There.
Yeah, the film in the end, you saw the scene with the triangle-shaped object, and that was pretty astounding because I was on the phone with Whitley complaining about not having an ending for the film. I said, I just don't have anything to really finish it off with. And so I'm looking up in the sky, and I see this thing morphing that I thought at first was an owl, you know, with the city lights casting up on its underbelly or something like that. And it kind of wobbled and like it was coming out of a cloaking field or something. And that there's this triangle, and it was really big, and it was really quiet, and it was real plain. It just had a light in each little corner, three lights. And I hear him on the phone with Whitley, and I'm thinking, I'm exasperated. It's like, I wish he could have been there, and I wish there's some way I could have got it on camera, not that anyone would have believed it if I had. And then the message came. It just came into my head. I heard it in the middle of my head. It said, there's still hope. Don't give up. So that became the ending. So maybe that was it. I don't know. But like I said, I've had so many. But that was a pretty amazing evening.
And that's a beginning.
Yeah. And now that thousands of people have seen the film, they'll write to me and they'll end it with, there's still hope, don't give up. They love that. And it's starting to become an expression.
Well, I am hoping that this goes global and that you have a ton of support, because I know people who are desperate to have this reality validated, so that they don't have to be made fun of and considered, you know, goofy, loopy, whatever. When the United States military finally said, yes, these are real, all of a sudden that changed the topic, and the mainstream began being more comfortable covering it. There's still the detractors and still people, you know, the skeptics.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. They're frightened. This really, you know, it's if you look at history, you know, I mean, here's poor old Galileo saying, oh, no, we're not the center of the universe. We're orbiting the sun. You go to jail for 8 years. That was it, you know, and that's still going on today. They don't want to change their paradigm. or reality, whatever you want to call it, their nice little bubble they live in. You come along and tell them, no, not everything that goes up has to come down. It doesn't.
No.
Those physics are not correct anymore. And, oh, don't you tell me that. What do you know? And blah, blah, blah. They get all upset with you, but it's true. The quantum physics was laughed at in the 80s. Now look at it.
Yeah.
And, of course, Webb goes up. Nobody's paying attention to Webb except us guys. And it's daily coming out with stuff that just completely defies everything we ever knew about the cosmos. And that's good. That's
yes.
fine.
It says we don't know it all.
Yeah, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. If we knew it all, what would be the point?
Well, I think life is a lot more interesting when there's a little bit of mystery. And this is a big mystery. And it says,
yeah,
wake up. We're here. Good luck.
Yeah, exactly.
There's still hope.
That.
There's still
yeah,
hope.
There's still hope. Don't give up.
I'll post links in the description for the show. If somebody contacts you, is just your YouTube channel, is that the best way?
They can. There's an email there. Mary reads them every morning, sometimes twice a day. And we get back to everybody. It's hard, but we do. And there's a lot of people coming forward that want to tell their story. So we're trying to work it out with them, how they can get out here to go in front of camera. Eventually, when we have more of a budget, we can actually travel to them if it's the hardship to them. But we have people coming from Stockholm and spending their own money to come here because they know they can go in front of the camera without fear of somebody cutting up what they say and changing what they said, because that's what Hollywood's always done. They'll take you saying, I don't think that was real. And then you'll watch the show and it says, I think it's real. There's just the way they'll edit stuff to suit their purposes. And they know that's not going to happen. They know they can come because they saw it with Daphne.
It pretty much says, we want the story, the real story.
Yeah.
Not the fiction,
yeah.
You know, not the embellishment. We want the story. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm going very low key on the effects. I'm putting in some because, after all, that's what I've done for years and years. And I have a feel for what these things look like. And I don't ever sensationalize it. Some people criticized that I was doing that. They said, it's very dangerous you doing that. You're trying to show us what you want us to see, not what the person in the story is seeing. And I said, I'm working with the person. They're telling me what I'm working from their drawings. I mean, come
on.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
So, but everyone else loves it. So.
Everyone's a critic. Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
That's like, no, don't bother. Don't bother.
Yeah.
Until they have something nice to say, listen to what mom says. If you can't say something nice, then don't say anything at all.
I've always stuck to that policy. I have. There's been plenty of things I've seen I didn't like, but it did go on the internet in front of the people who made it, in front of the people supporting them, saying that was a bunch of crap. I just would never do that. That's just mean. We don't do bullies.
So the email, this is for youtube.com/@Steve Neill, N-E-I-L-L. You also have a blog. You're on Substack. And I love the blog with all the pictures and the links. And in August, you said, okay, this is the end. I'm like, I just found it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. That I had to bring that website WordPress to an end because it's just, I have too much to do. And so, but that's sort of like a portfolio. It's a storage place of all the work I've done in the past.
And that is The Art of Steve Neill. If you're looking for that, stevenails.art.blog on WordPress, and it links to the Substack site, so you can do that.
Yeah, and they should really read, in my Substack, I have short stories. They should really read The Double Slit Experiment, which is my next film. But I actually wrote it as a short story first, and they can read that. I think they might enjoy it, because it's sort of my reflection on this whole experience. The story is fictional, but the contents are not necessarily fictional.
So. Okay. Yeah, I'm just now opening it up to see it, so I will be reading that too.
Yeah, it's a wild ride.
I went right to, I wanted so much for this, for our planet, our human race. I knew it was possible because her people made it. And okay, so there you go. This is your hope for the future?
It's interesting. I'm a very strong believer. I mean, I'm a big Philip K. Dick fan and Man in the High Castle. I don't know how many people know about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, yes. Philip K.
Well,
Dick.
Then, uh-huh. Then you know that people actually have experienced parallel worlds, myself included. When I was a kid, dreamed about a world where the Japanese and the Germans had won the war. And then here comes along Philip K. Dick and his book, and the very good TV series they did out of it. And I was just amazed, and I had to look into it more deeply and found out that I wasn't the only person, here we go again, that had had this experience. So parallel worlds actually do exist, I believe. And I think that, that sometimes we don't know we've shifted to another one. It's because the differences are subtle. But then impossible things happen within your reality you could have never dreamed of, like someone who should have never been president being president. It was too fantastic and difficult to believe, and you wonder, what happened?
Mine was subtle. It was all the cars. I could tell. There were no colors. It was all either black, white, silver, gray, and no colors. And that was how I knew, okay, this isn't my reality. And I was told, do not telegraph. You don't want to stay. You're visiting. And that was, but that was really, that was helpful.
Yeah.
That
was... I've had some real scary ones. But then there's the Mandela effect. You knew all about that too, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, I know darn well that that Monopoly guy had a monocle.
Yes.
But they're saying he didn't.
Like,
yet I found the artwork.
Well, he always had a monocle.
Yeah, but they're saying that, no, he didn't. This is only one case. There's so many other cases. There's movies that were never made, and the actors that were involved in will tell you they never did that film, and yet you can find copies of them.
Like, okay, where do we shift? Yeah. Cynthia Sue Larson has a great site with all of that, realityshifters.com, I believe is the site.
But, oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I always go back to what Jimmy Church once said to me. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. So eventually we might know. And not now. Yeah.
Not now.
Yeah, not now.
Not now.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Oh, sure. You bet. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me on.
Links are in the description for the show. Check out Steve's art, steveneal.art.blog on WordPress, and you can find the masks that he creates. And he does videos to show you how he creates them. On YouTube, Steve's channel, Steve Neal, YouTube. Thanks for listening. Stay curious.